Chapter 3. Finding Valuable Ore. Cautiously we crept forward. Shrouded in the darkness, somewhere in front of us was the swollen creek. When our ears told us we were right upon it, we got on our knees and crawled, feeling for the 6-inch log bridge. "It's here! It's here! It's still here!" I shouted to my companion as I found the log still a little above the swift water. "Here, you hold this end till I get across. Then I'll hold the other end while you get across." Then, carefully straddling the pole with my feet dangling in the water, I pulled myself across little by little. In a minute or two my companion came across, and on we went in the darkness and the rain, creeping, crawling, stumbling for seemingly endless hours. We journeyed, and then, "A light! A light! Look! We're there! It's Tiger Village!" I cried and made straight for the light. In my delight, I hadn't figured that, of course, the trail to the light would not be straight. So the next thing I knew, I had stumbled right over a low barricade into horrible smelly mud. It turned out to be a pigsty, and the pigs strongly objected to latecomers. They raced round and round, grunting and snorting, and no one could ever have told who of us was the most terrified. I only know that by the time I got out of that pigsty, I must have been a shocking sight. It was no wonder that when I knocked on the bamboo wall of the house where the light was, the woman screamed, "Who are you? Who are you?" "It's me, Auntie," I called, "the White Tara of Onondaga." "Oh, no, it's not. No, it's not," she yelled. "He's been drowned, and this is his ghost come to haunt me." "I'm no ghost, Auntie," I said. "I've been lost, and I can't find my way home. Please show me where the headman's house is." "Well," she said, calming down, "if it's really you yourself, that's the headman's house over there by that coconut palm." And in a few minutes we were with friends. I was surprised to find it was just 8:30. "We are so glad you found your way back, Tara," said the headman kindly. "You may never have lived through the night in a storm like that." His good wife quickly brought us a plate of hot rice each, and a little square of dried fish. Oh, but it did taste good, and I was hungry enough to do it justice. While I feasted, my good hostess stood eyeing my bedraggled appearance, and as I washed my hands, she said, "Now, Tara, you'll have to change your clothes. You can't sleep in those dirty, muddy things." "But, Auntie," I said, "this is all I have." "Oh, that doesn't matter," she said, throwing a little bundle to me. "Here's a loincloth. Put that on while I rinse out your things." After pondering the situation for a second, I decided to make the best of it, and going inside, I took off my dirty wet clothes and came forth adorned in the loincloth. Now, it was perfectly modest and covered me from my hips to my knees, and of course there was quite a lot of brother hair on the outside. And while my clothes were being rinsed, I went over to the fireplace to keep warm. Soon my hostess was sitting on the other side of the fireplace, drying my clothes, and the world began to take on a happier and more comfortable aspect. In a minute or two, however, we had visitors. 3 neighborly grandmothers, feeling that something interesting was going on at the headman's house, had come to see, and now sat with my hostess on the other side of the open fireplace. Taking advantage of the opportunity, they at once joined my anatomy class, and after studying me in silence, presently began to recite aloud. Said the first one, "Look at his white chest!" If his face was white like that, wouldn't he be pretty? Said the second, look at his arms. The top half is white like a white man, and the bottom half is brown like a Karen. Said number three, and look, even his long legs are white. Whoever would have thought that his legs would be white? Then my hostess, bless her heart, came to my rescue. Never mind you, ladies, she said. Tara is every bit as good-looking as Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden. I smiled, too, when I told Mrs. Hare the next day, but it wasn't a bit funny that stormy night. I was grateful to be safe, and doubly grateful to realize that the jungle folk were remembering the Bible stories I had been telling them. Even the hard bamboo floor felt soft and friendly as, dressed once more in my own dry clothes, I lay down to sleep. In the morning it was very easy to find our way to the river. We discovered that there were two trails out of the third rice clearing. One led into the trouble of the day before, the other led straight to the river. I cannot say too much in praise of the efficient, faithful work done by Nurse May Gibbs during those months in the little jungle dispensary. Had not the old village headman said, "Nobody will come for fear of the haunted pagoda?" He didn't know. He forgot to realize that the devil worshippers feared nothing more than death, and in spite of his fears and his prophecies, they came. Sick babies, sick mothers, sick uncles, sick aunties, nearly dead with malaria, dysentery, and pneumonia, almost frantic with the pain from sore eyes, aching teeth, terrible boils and abscesses, loathsome with skin diseases and ringworm. Miss Gibbs cared for them all. Wherever I went as I attempted to visit these patients in their villages, I carried a medicine bag, and we were thus able to save hundreds of lives and make hundreds of friends. The need and the sorrow spurred us ever on and drove us nearer and nearer to the side of the loving physician who had promised to be with us always. "Doctor, doctor," cried a man in a village 12 miles away from our dispensary. "Have you got any burn medicine?" "Surely I have," I replied. "When did your little girl burn herself?" "When? Oh, about 7 years ago," was his surprising reply. "But what can I do for a burn 7 years old?" I groaned. "Well, come up and have a look anyway," he urged. So I climbed up the little bamboo ladder into his house. In the dim light I could see nothing, for there were no windows to their huts. I heard him call his daughter to come. In answer I heard something that sounded like a kangaroo hopping. The next minute a 12-year-old girl stood before me on one leg, while her father told me, when she was a little tot 5 years old, one evening her dress caught on fire, and it burned all of one leg, one side of her body, and one arm. Then, because we had no medicine, and because the missionaries hadn't come yet, and because the government hospital was too far away, and because it hurt to be exposed to the air, she huddled in the corner in the darkness and cried. In 6 months her little leg and body had grown together. He looked hopefully into my face for a moment, then pleaded, "Now, doctor, have you some burn medicine to give her, so that she can run and walk and play like other children again?" "Oh, you must take her to the hospital in Moulmein," I cried. "No, no, we are afraid of the hospital in Moulmein. It's too far away. Please, won't you give her some medicine so that she can run and walk and play again?" Of course, I had no medicine like that, and pausing only to tell her of a God who had power to save and make whole all who believe on him, I hurried on with a heavy heart. "Doctor, doctor," cried a jungle mother nearby, with a 2-year-old baby on her arm. "Doctor, I think my baby has the toothache." I said it surely has something of the kind, for it was screaming at the top of its voice and scratching and clawing at its little mouth. On opening its mouth, I found that it had a tooth infection, and the tooth had rotted out. I cleaned up the place where the tooth had been, but as there seemed to be a little piece of the root left, I selected a sharp-pointed pair of forceps and tried to pull it out. But I pulled out instead 3 wriggling maggots. Can you wonder I talk of need? Can you wonder that I say it spurred us on? Our medical work was not without its results. Only in the new villages did we hear the cry of "Dataka, Dataka" anymore. And wherever we had been, the people began to call us the White Brother and to ask, "When are you going to start a school at Owendaw? We want our children, whose lives you have saved, to go to your school and learn about God." At the dispensary, they talked in the same way to Nurse Gibbs. We began to make a list, and soon we had the names of 50 boys and girls who wanted to come to the mission school. I took the list to our mission committee in Rangoon and begged for a teacher. They rejoiced with me over the prospects and called a faithful young Karen man from our training school at Mektila, whose name was Peter, to be the teacher of the Owendaw school. On our way up the river, we laid our plans, and though we had only one small bamboo house available, we decided to advertise our school at once and get started as soon as possible. Accordingly, the next week we went everywhere, all around our district, visiting our old dispensary friends and broadcasting everywhere. Next Monday at 9 o'clock in the morning, we are going to open school. Be sure to come next Monday morning. "Ugh, ugh, ah, ah," grunted our friends as they smiled at the news. So it was with light hearts that we opened school at 9 o'clock next Monday morning. That is, we opened the school house. We opened up the front door, dusted off the seats, put a piece of chalk in front of the blackboard, and put the chair behind the table, and then I walked up and down with my watch in my hand, waiting for the boys and girls to come. And I walked up and down, and walked up and down, but nobody came. And I said to Peter, "Now, what are we going to do?" "Well," he said thoughtfully, "you know the jungle folks don't know the days of the week very well. Maybe they have got mixed up, and they think it's tomorrow." "Oh, then," I said, "we'll open school again tomorrow." And so we did. That is, we opened the school house, we opened up the front door, and dusted off the seats, and put the piece of chalk in front of the blackboard, and put the chair behind the table. Then again I walked up and down, with my watch in my hand, waiting for the boys and girls to come. I walked up and down, and I walked up and down, but it was no use. Nobody came. So I said to Peter, "Now what are we going to do?" And he said, "Maybe, Tara, they expect us to go and bring the children to school." And I said, "Maybe they do. Then tomorrow morning, instead of opening school, we will go over to Ka Mali and get Tonpei and Natu, Hlakin's little brother and sister. I just know they are going to come." So the next morning, instead of opening school, we crossed the river and away we went to Ka Mali, 8 miles away. When we got there, sure enough, Tonpei and Natu were all ready. Their mats were all rolled up, and their slates and clothes all tied in a big handkerchief. Smiling as they saw us, they said, "We just knew you would come. That's why we didn't go yesterday or the day before." "All right, here we are. Let's go," I urged, "because no one has come yet, and I suppose everybody else is waiting for someone to come first." And taking Natu with one hand and Tonpei with the other, we were just about to start off when Na Kaya Te said, "Oh, Tara, Tonpei has been going down to the Buddhist school. I think he had better go and get his certificate of transfer. He will only be a minute." So we sat down for a minute while Tonpei got over the fence and went down the trail towards the temple school after his certificate of transfer. We waited 10 minutes, and Tonpei didn't come back. "Whatever do you suppose is keeping him?" I asked the mother. "I don't know, Tara," she said, "but don't worry. I'll just run down and have a look." And she got over the fence and disappeared down the trail that led to the temple school. We waited 10 more minutes, but she didn't come back. "Do you suppose something has happened to Tonpei?" I asked the married sister. "I don't know, I'm sure," she said. "But don't worry, Tara. I'll go and have a look." And she got over the fence and disappeared down the trail that led to the temple school. We waited 10 more minutes, but she didn't come back. Then the auntie went to have a look, and she didn't come back. Last of all, the grandma went to have a look, and she didn't come back. "Peter," I said after waiting 10 more minutes, "whatever can have happened?" "I don't know, I'm sure, Tara," he said, "but don't you worry, I'll..." "No, you won't," I said. "If anybody else has to go, I'll go myself." Getting over the fence, I started off down the trail that led to the temple school to have a look, and what do you suppose I saw? The yellow-robed, shaven-headed Buddhist priest was standing on the steps of his schoolhouse, cursing the white god worshippers. "Of course I won't let one of my boys sit at the feet of a Christian dog," he growled. And the mother, the sister, the auntie, and the grandma knelt in the dust, afraid to move. He was speaking in Burmese, however, and I couldn't understand what he said. "Where's Tonpei?" I asked in Karen, and half a dozen boys pointed to Tonpei crying behind the door. Then I did something terrible. I wouldn't do it now, but I didn't know any better then. Do you know what I did? I walked right up the steps into the Buddhist school with my boots on. With my boots on! It was too terrible for words. The priest was speechless. "Come on, Tonpei," I said, taking his hand and going out. "Come on, mother, sister, auntie, grandma. We don't need any certificate of transfer." They got up and followed me back to the house. As we moved away, the priest's tongue was loosed, and you should have heard the abuse. "I wish," he yelled, "that in the next life the Christian dog is born into a cow with horns on, and after that into a slimy maggot." By the time this was translated to me, we had reached the house and it didn't matter. We just took a deep breath, heaved a big sigh, and saying goodbye went off with Tonpei and Natu to Owendaw. The next day we began school. We opened up the front door, dusted off the chairs, and put the piece of chalk in front of the blackboard. Peter sat on the chair behind the table, well, Tonpei sat at one end and Natu at the other. "Be faithful, Peter," I called, "while I go out and bring back some more." Then off I went to some more villages. At night I came back and inquired, "Did any more children come today, Peter?" "No, Tara, how many did you get?" he replied. "Oh, they are coming tomorrow, Peter," I said. And the next day Peter taught school with 2 children, while I went to gather some more. But they didn't come that day, or the next day, or the next. For 3 weeks Peter taught school with Tong Pei and Na Tu, while I canvassed and canvassed the country for more children, but none came. Na Du was all ready to come, but her father had a bad dream, so she couldn't leave. Ang Tu was just leaving the house when his little sister cut her finger, and that was a bad sign, so he couldn't come. The baby cried when Tun Mong was getting ready, and a plate broke when Sa Thu was eating his breakfast, so of course they couldn't come. But behind all these bad omens and signs was the all-absorbing fear that maybe, after all, the white god worshippers were Da Takas and would feed their children and fatten them up and then eat them. Anyway, the yellow-robed priests said they would, and so the children were not permitted to come. After we had tried unsuccessfully for 3 weeks to get them to school, Peter said, "Tara, what are we going to do now?" "Peter," I said, "there's only one more thing we can do. Come and I will show you." And we got on our knees around the dear old book and opened the pages to Isaiah 55:8-11. Then we prayed, "Lord, thou hast said thy word shall not return unto thee void, but it shall accomplish that which thou desirest, and it shall prosper in the thing whereto thou hast sent it." Then we told the Lord that we had done all we could and had no strength to do more, but since he had the power and there was nothing impossible for him, we believed he would help us find the treasure hidden beneath all this fear and superstition. And do you know? Right away something began to happen. The very next day 2 more children came from Mazita, then 1 from Nota, 2 more from Thadeo, and 1 from Kalon, and by the end of the next week we had 10 students. You can have no idea of how many 10 can be till you have worked for them as hard as we worked for that 10. How they rejoiced my heart! I counted them in the morning when we got up. I counted them when they went to school. I counted them at play. And I counted them when they went to bed at night. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Our school was established at last, and I knew that given a chance it would grow. We taught them how to sing "Jesus Loves Me, This I Know." Long ago the children sang a song, "And When He Cometh to Gather His Jewels." We taught them to sing soprano and alto. Peter sang bass and I sang tenor. Then we put them into our bullock wagon, or our motor launch, and took them to their villages. And standing up in a little ring, we sang to their mothers and fathers and aunties and uncles. They crowded around. "Who are these that sing?" they said. "Are these angels from heaven?" "Why, no," I replied. "They are your own children. Look, don't you know them?" "Oh, no, they are not. Our children don't comb their hair like that. Our children don't have clean clothes like that. Our children don't have shiny faces like that," they said, shaking their heads. "But they are your children," I protested. "Look, here's Na Du, And Nadu's mother looked at her own little girl for the longest time, till finally a smile broke out on her face, and she said, "Why, so it is, so it is. The Dathakas haven't eaten her after all." And from that moment we knew that we were getting nearer and nearer the treasure in the land of the haunted pagoda. With hardly an effort, our attendance increased to 26 the next year, and the year after that it increased to 34, and our joy would have been complete but for the fact that furlough time had arrived for our faithful nurse Gibbs, and we had to say goodbye to her for a time. However, that year, as if to make up for the loneliness and added burdens, God gave us the first fruits of our labors. I will never forget the day when Hla Kin said to me, "Dara, I've been here nearly 3 years now, and I've learned to work, and I've learned to read. Every spare moment I have been reading the Golden Book, and I've found Jesus, and I believe he is the Son of God. And Thara, I would like to be baptized and become a God-worshipper, too." "Bless your heart, Hla Kin," I said. "Next time Mother comes down, we will ask her what she thinks of it, and then we will make arrangements for you to be baptized." In a few days, when Na Kaya Ti happened to be coming by, I said, "Auntie, your big girl wants to be baptized and become a God-worshipper. How do you feel about it?" "I don't care if she does," she replied. "We have worshipped the devils all our lives, and they are no good. I don't care if she does become a God-worshipper. Maybe when I know a little more, I might become a God-worshipper too." So we called for an ordained minister to come and baptize Hla Kin, for I was not ordained at the time. And who do you think came? Pastor A.H. Williams, who along with Pastor J.A. Hamilton had discovered Ondah as a mission site. What a happy day it was for us. Our boys and girls and a few friends stood around on the river bank singing, "Happy day, happy day, when Jesus washed my sins away." Well, Hla Kin was baptized in the great Salween River. We had found treasure at last, treasure more valuable than gold. But away back in the village where Hla Kin's mother lived, it was a different story. "Did you hear? Did you hear?" called the old ladies in excitement. "Those God worshippers took that woman's daughter and dipped her right down underneath the water. Oh, isn't it terrible? Isn't it terrible? Now they will come to our village and catch all of us and dip us all down under the water. Oh, what will we do? What will we do? We won't let her live here any more. We won't. We won't have her here any longer. We won't." So they called the Buddhist priest and had him curse poor old Na Kaya Ti and her house and her children. Then with sticks and stones they drove her away. "What will I do now, Tara?" she appealed to me the next day. "They have driven me out." "Well, auntie," I replied, "I think their anger will soon pass over when they see that nothing happens. And I can get police protection for you if you wish, you know, for the British government guarantees religious freedom to each of its subjects." "No, no, Tara. I don't want to live there any more. I want to go away." "Then," I said, "Hla Kin and your two little children are here. You just go off visiting some of your relatives and think things over for a week or two." So everything worked out all right for Na Kaya Ti, But back in her village there was more trouble. They say that after she left, because there was no one to put the rice on the spirit altar each day, the devils got angry and came down and haunted that house, and at night the village folk were terrified with the screaming and yelling and groaning that issued forth from the empty house. "We can't stand it," said the elders as they gathered in the village council. "The house is worse than the old woman. It is, it is." "What shall we do?" asked the headman. I know, said one. "Let's burn it down." "Fine, fine," chorused the elders. "You strike the first match," ordered the headman. "Oh, no, not me. I'm afraid of the devils. Not me, not me," they cried. And not a man there was brave enough to strike the first match to burn it down. "I know," cried another. "Let us pull it down. We can all pull a board off and..." "Fine, fine," chorused the elders. "You pull the first board off," ordered the head man of the one who had suggested the plan. "Oh, no, no, I couldn't do that. I'm afraid," he cried, and not a man in the crowd was found brave enough to pull the first board off. "I know," said another. "Let's send for the old woman and make her come and pull it down herself." "Fine, fine," chorused the elders. "You go and call the old woman," ordered the head man. So off he went across the rice field through the jungle to Kaloni, where poor old Nakaya T was taking refuge. And the next day she stood before me again telling me of her trouble. "I'm only a little old woman," she cried. "How can I pull a house down? How I wish I could sell it somehow. I would like to go and live somewhere else." Now it just happened, or did it just happen, that 5 days before I had received 200 rupees from the mission committee to buy a new house for our boys. Our school was growing, and I was looking around for some lumber to build with, so I said, "Auntie, are the posts of your house still good?" "Good as the day the house was built," she replied. "We got the best hardwood posts." "And are the floorboards still good?" I inquired further. "Just as good as can be." "Then why don't you sell the house to me, if you really don't want to live in it," I said, "and I'll go over and pull the house down." "Oh, Thara, if you would, I'd sell it to you for 50 rupees, she said. The next day we went to see the village elders, and I proposed that they let me pay her 50 rupees for the posts and the floorboards. Then I'd come with some of my big boys and pull the old house down. They were delighted. They didn't care what the devils did to the white god worshippers. The more the better, the quicker the sooner. So they encouraged me to come as soon as possible and take the old haunted house away. In a few days, with a half dozen bullock wagons and about a dozen big boys and some crowbars and hammers, we arrived all ready for business. "Here they are, here they are," excitedly called the villagers to each other. "Come and let's see what the devils will do." And they stood around us in a big circle, expecting to see the devils utterly demolish the god-worshippers. But what do you think they saw? They saw the big boys from the mission school climbing up on the posts onto the roof, till at last they sat straddle-legged on the top of the haunted house, while they sang and whistled onward Christian soldiers marching as to war. That's what they saw. And one by one the pieces of leaf thatch were thrown down. One by one the bamboo rafters were thrown down. One by one the floorboards were pulled up, and one by one the posts were pulled over, till by noon the whole house was torn down, and nobody's head had been crushed, nobody's arms or legs had been broken, and as far as we knew, nobody had even got a splinter in his finger. The devil worshippers couldn't believe it. Their devils had no power over the God worshippers. Taking one more look to make sure it was true, they turned and ran to their houses and huts to hide themselves. We soon had our wagons loaded, and by evening the old haunted house was carted to the river bank opposite our mission station. "Well, Peter," I said, surveying the pile of lumber and posts, "how are we going to get this across the river? We can't load it into the launch or canoe. They are not big enough. What have you got to suggest?" "I have been thinking, Zara," he replied. "Some of these posts are too heavy to float, but some of them are light, and I believe that if we tie them all together in a raft, it will float enough so that we can pull it across the river with the launch." "Splendid, Peter," I exclaimed, and the next day we put some skids in the shallow water, drove in some posts at the end, and began to make our raft. When it was done, we tied big ropes around it, pulled out the posts, and levered it off into the deep water, and it floated. It did, it did. About half an inch above the water, we brought the launch and tied a big rope securely to the back of the launch and headed upstream, so that when the current caught us and swung us downstream, we would land somewhere on our mission property. The engines chugged away courageously. We gained momentum with our raft, and I was rejoicing at our success, when all of a sudden Peter grabbed my arm and, pointing out of the back of the launch, shouted, "Look, Zara, look!" I looked, but everything seemed all right. There was a little ripple behind the launch flowing gently over the raft, but our ropes were holding and all seemed well. "What's the matter, Peter? It's all right," I assured him. "But, Zara, look, look!" he still shouted. "Yes, but look what?" I asked, quite puzzled. "Why, look, Zara, the water is going right over the house. The house is getting baptized. The house is getting baptized." "Sure enough it is," I said. "Peter, this is our second convert. And do you know that house was converted? In just 3 weeks it was rebuilt on the mission property. The same old posts, the same old boards, new bamboo walls and a new leaf roof. There was only one part of the old house that we didn't use, and that was the spirit altar built onto the middle post upstairs. We threw it into the river to be carried away to the depths of the ocean, and just where the altar used to be, Peter put his study table. Right where the offering plate used to be, Peter kept his Bible. Instead of the screaming and yelling of evil spirits every evening, the boys gathered around and sang, 'What a wonderful change in my life has been wrought since Jesus came into my heart. How we rejoice to see the powers of darkness beginning to fall back.'" The story of the house was told everywhere. Hundreds of people began to lose faith in the devils, and the next year 57 students enrolled in our school. Another teacher was added to our staff, and prospects were never better when one day Peter came to me quite worried. "Zara," he said, "we will have to do something about our drinking water. The river is too dirty and too full of germs to drink without boiling it. And by the time we let it settle, then boil it, the children are so thirsty that they drink it all up while it is hot, so that we have to boil another canful." "I know, Peter," I sympathized. "I've been thinking about it for a long time, and I think we had better dig a well." "Splendid," he said. "I'm so glad you know how to dig a well." "But I don't," I replied. "I've never even helped to dig a well in all my life." "Then what will we do, for I don't know how," responded Peter sadly. "Don't let that worry you for a minute," I encouraged. "We'll dig a well anyway." And so we did. That is, we dug a hole, and though it was 6 feet across at the top and only 3 feet across at the bottom, at a depth of 40 feet we struck water, beautiful, clear, sparkling, fresh water. Unless you have dug a well, you can't imagine how good it feels to strike water. I was on the shift at work when a shovelful of gravel was dug out and a shovelful of water took its place. What shouting and yelling and rejoicing there was! The buckets raced up and down at double speed until we had 2 feet of lovely clear water in our well. Then I crawled up, went home, had a bath, changed my clothes, and walked up and down on the veranda, feeling good all over. I was still walking up and down on the veranda, feeling good all over, when Peter came rushing up the stairs. "Thara, we're in trouble again," he cried. "What is it this time?" I groaned. "Our well is caving in, Thara. The gravel is so soft that as we draw the water out, we can hear it caving in." "Don't worry another minute, Peter," I said. "All we have to do is brick up our well. You know, everybody bricks up wells so they can't cave in." "Yes, but Thara, where are we going to get the bricks?" "There are all the bricks you need in the world at Molmean, Peter." "Yes, Thara, but it takes 5 days to get there, 5 to get back, and in 10 days our well will be all spoiled." "Well, can't we get some more bricks nearby somewhere? I've already inquired, Thara, and there isn't a brick within 20 miles of us for sale." "Then we'll have to sit down and think, Peter." "Well, sit down quick, Thara, and think quick. Our well is caving in." So we sat down and thought and thought. "And Peter," I said suddenly, "I know. What about the old haunted?" "Oh, yes," broke in Peter. "Why didn't I think about that before? The old haunted pagoda." Taking a dozen of our big boys and a dozen hoes, we went to the old pagoda, dug over the ruins, and what do you think we found? 4,000 good whole bricks. We put them in rice sacks and carried them on our shoulders and brought them to our well, which we lined with all these fine bricks from the old haunted pagoda. "Peter," I said, as we laid the last of the bricks, layer by layer, about halfway up from the bottom of the well, "Peter, we have found the treasure, haven't we?" "Surely we have, Thara, real treasure. And just to think, God had these bricks made for us and carted to the mission station for us before we were born." "Ah, yes, it's wonderful," I began to reply. But just then a groan, a howl, clear and distinct, seeming to come from the very bricks we had just put down, startled us. "Did you hear that, Peter?" I inquired. But he didn't answer, because the sound came again louder and more distinct than before. We looked at each other. We knew our faces had suddenly gone pale, and Peter's voice trembled as he said, "Do you think it might be the curse? Has the curse overtaken us?"